Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtables Live broadcast from Stockbridge, Massachusetts. I'm Joe Donahue. We are broadcasting from the famed Fitzpatrick Main Stage, one of three stages that make up the Berkshire Theater Group.
I'm Alan Chartok. Yes, for many years, this was known as the Berkshire Theater Festival. Now, along with the acquisition of the Colonial Theater and the addition of the Unicorn Theater, it all makes up the Berkshire Theater Group.
So we start off this morning with a check on Berkshire headlines and Berkshire happenings with our main source from the Berkshire Eagle reporter and regular Wednesday panelist Jen Smith, who is in traffic but will be with us in a few moments. So we welcome our host immediately, BTG Artistic Director and CEO Kate McGuire, who is here. Good morning, Kate. How are you?
Good morning. I'm happy to be here. Thank you so much, Joe.
Well, thank you for inviting us.
Of course.
It was very nice. You know, we don't get out much. People don't invite us. So it's nice that you invited us. Thank you. It's been 10 years since we were here.
That's right.
We celebrated the 80th. We'll celebrate the 90th.
And we'll celebrate the 100th.
We'll be here.
We'll be here.
You know
right?
it. And your husband's here, too. He is a BTG actor and director and a dear friend of ours, Eric Hill. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Good morning, Alan.
Well, it's very nice to have you here. We'll, as I mentioned, Jen Smith will be joining us in a minute. She checked in just a few moments ago and is in the chaos of Berkshire traffic this morning.
Isn't that amazing? She gets over to Albany all the time.
On time.
On time.
Yeah.
Today,
you probably
traffic.
Get a false sense of security because you think you can do it and, you know, because it's only 5 minutes from the house and then you get behind a tractor
exactly.
and you're kind of screwed.
Yep.
Can you say that?
I just did.
Yeah.
So,
no,
so the season for not just you, but for everybody is getting underway. It is crazy time. So it's, you're starting to see the people come in.
It's like Boston in the fall when all the college kids arrive.
Yeah.
But it's the spring and all the college kids are coming here to work as interns at all the amazing cultural institutions. And all the actors are arriving, and we're all buffing up and getting ready.
It's like the beginning of camp.
That's right.
So my question to you is this the oldest or the second oldest theater festival in the country?
You know, it's probably the third oldest, actually.
Oh.
But it
is
was...
Is there a caveat?
We all argue about it.
Okay.
And so I think that we're the third... founded in 1928. The building was built in 1888. So the building we're in, which was the Stockbridge Casino, was originally located on Main Street. Mabel Choate, the Grand Dame of Stockbridge, wanted to bring the Mission House, which was on Prospect Hill, down to Main Street.
All right.
So she said in 1928, that casino is falling apart, and we're not going to put the money into it to renovate. Does anybody want it? And three gentlemen said, yes, we'll buy it. Daniel Chester French, Walter Clark, and Austin Riggs bought the building from Mabel Choate for a dollar. They took it apart, and they moved it to where we are sitting right now in 1928, and it became the Berkshire Playhouse, founded on the inspiration of the great American... Well, she was born in England, actually, but great English-speaking actress Eva Galeon, who was going to the Roosevelts constantly saying, please, there are theaters in Chicago, there are theaters in Boston, there are theaters in New York. We need theaters around the country.
Right.
And so gradually members of her company became artistic directors all over.
So what were the other two that could be older?
The Goodman, the Guthrie.
All right.
There's the Cape Cod Playhouse, which is about the same time.
Yeah. So, for the purposes of our conversation, we can say
we're the oldest.
Yeah. All right. I see no reason to not say that. Jen Smith is with us. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm well, Joe. I feel like it's been forever.
I know. It's good to it's good to have you here. We're thrilled that you're here. So we've been talking about that. This is the time, right? This is a big deal for the Berkshires. I wrote Jen a note last night. I said we're going to be talking about it culturally, socially, psychologically, economically, all of those things at play here when it comes to pardon the pun, play, when it comes to the art season in the Berkshires.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it definitely starts this week with, you know, Barrington Stage just had a world premiere, and then you guys have a show coming up. I cover a lot of education stuff, so I know that the summer youth theater programs are on their way. I see the Tarzan billboards around. I've been talking with Travis Daly about that from Berkshire Theater Group. So it's a very exciting time of year. You start seeing the shifts in the crowds of people who are just coming into the downtown area. I think it's a great opportunity to just learn a lot more. And I think one of the interesting things that you're seeing in theater locally is that it's not just about going to see the production, but it's about the conversations people are having afterwards about what they've seen.
Right. And we'll get into that in a few minutes. Do you know who the audience is pretty much at this point, Kate, of who's coming in, and or does that change? Does that drift from season to season?
I don't know that it drifts from season to season, but it certainly has evolved. I mean, many of the audience members are folks that came here when they were young for camps, and they decided to buy a house here later on. But there are more and more young folks getting here from New York, we're finding. If the train ever comes through, that'll be a huge help. But each theater has different audiences for us. So there's the main stage, where our audiences have been coming since 1928, and many of them have been coming since 1928.
So they're
thankfully
trained.
And there's the Unicorn, which is a spot where people can go to see theater that may be a little edgier. And the Colonial is a space where there are new audiences coming to the theater and trying things out for the first time. And those audiences may have been folks that grew up here in the Berkshires, but never ventured into one of the theaters in the summertime before. A lot of what we think about is, how do we make theater less intimidating? How do we make sure that people feel comfortable to walk in the doors?
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the train. Do you mind if I just go in that direction for a second?
I'd love it.
I think part of the train campaign has to do with what train. I mean, if a train comes up through New York, through the old way that it used to, and stops at Stockbridge, this would be great.
Yep.
But if you have to go back to Pittsfield for a three-hour or four-hour sojourn into New York City, that's a lot, isn't it?
A three-hour sojourn would not be too bad.
But a four-hour?
Well, then it starts to get a little trickier, I think. But just the idea that you can take a train to the Berkshires alone would be helpful, I think, Alan. I really do, and I think starting to get that moving. I mean, there's a jitney from New York City that goes to the Hamptons every summer.
That's right.
Wouldn't it be great to have that jitney that came through from New York? And we should work on that.
That's a great idea.
It's something that, I mean, it's a huge issue, and it's something that I've seen there's been a few festivals in this area that have happened where they've chartered buses from either Boston or New York to try to get more people in. So there's definitely a demand and a need and for a vision for a pathway to get from surrounding areas, because we know as drivers, as car owners, it's easy for us to, you know, go down to Wissahick or and catch the train into the cities, but it would be great to have a two-way pathway going back and forth. But it does, I think, Alan, you're right, it does have to be something that's articulated and mindful of people's time.
That's right.
You know, you want to get the trip out here so you can enjoy and relax. That's what the theme of the Berkshires is.
Not to be a naysayer, but I have to tell you, there was a bus that went from Wissahick, which is the closest point in, to the Berkshires, and it's not there anymore. I don't think it was overly subscribed.
Interesting.
Yeah, if you look at rideshare boards and stuff, the story would say otherwise. There's always people saying anyone heading to the train station, you know, I think you have local kind of Lyft or informal car service, car ride sharing heading down. So there definitely is a demand, but I think it needs to be rebuilt, and I think it needs to be marketed in a way that's usable. Mindful of that, if a show is getting out late, people want to grab something before they head to the train or something. I think the timetables need to be mindful of that as well. And same thing before the show.
Speaking of which, Kate, the most interesting thing, or one of the interesting things about this, is that you now have dinner theater here. Can you talk about that for a minute?
A few years ago, we recognized that It might make it easier for our patrons to just come by, have a salad, have a sandwich before the show. So we created Jane's Cafe, and you can come a little early, have a bite to eat, and then just move right into a seat here at the main stage. You can also do it at the patio at the Unicorn Theater. It's not only about making the theater less intimidating, but it's also about how does the audience arrive to see a show. So if the audience is rushing in, parking their car, they're still on their phone, they sit in their seat, they actually miss the first 5 or 10 minutes of the play. So if the audience is here beforehand, sort of settling in, getting ready for the play, mindful of what they're about to see, it's a better experience all around.
Joe, can I ask one more tributary question here? And that is that you mentioned Jane's Cafe and the Fitzpatrick main stage. For those of us of a certain age, we do remember the Fitzpatricks, and we remember them well. They owned the Red Lion, Country Curtains, they did all of that. They were extraordinarily generous people, weren't they?
Oh, I don't think that the Berkshires as we know it would be the Berkshires as we know it without the generosity of the Fitzpatrick family. And I feel completely blessed to have worked with Jane Fitzpatrick, who was the president of the board here for over 20 years and continued her care of this theater until she passed, but she really understood what it meant to create a community. She ran Country Curtains, she and the senator. A lot of people worked there that were in this community. And then beyond that, supported all of the culturals, and our neighborhood became a lot stronger because of the Fitzpatricks.
I want to go to a word that you used a couple of times in regards to the audience and making people comfortable when they come in, and that is to go against that idea of intimidation. Mm-hmm. So, Eric, as a director, a longtime director here, and actor, of course, how do you address that? How do you get audiences trained for a better word, looking for a better word, to break down that intimidation wall?
That's a good question. A lot of thinking goes into, for me, how people come to the theater, how they walk through the door, and what they see when they sit down and look at the stage. You know, coming to the theater can be an intimidating experience for a lot of people. A lot of people have never been to the theater. They don't know what a serious play is, really. They may have seen a musical back in high school. But to make the theater going experience something that invites them in rather than puts them off is crucial, because invariably in theater, the issues that you're going to raise are going to raise people's attention in ways that is sometimes confrontational. They're not going to always agree with what they see, but you don't want to put them off before they walk through the door. There's an embrace that theater has to perform, I think, in order to be effective. That is, when people come to your front door, the people who greet them, the ticket people, the marketing people, the way they're seated into the theater, the fact that they're going to a theater in the countryside and not in the city, there's a huge difference between those two things. People arrive at the theater in New York City and they're coming from their job and they're, you know, packing stuff into their wall, or they're in a kerfuffle. Here they arrive, they've had dinner, they're mellow. They're willing to come into the theater and kind of relax.
Kerfuffleless, if you will.
Kerfuffleless. And that's where you want them, because their defenses are down and they're a little bit more open. And if they have a wonderful experience walking through the door and then the first thing they see is something beautiful, it makes them sit back and go, okay, I can take this in. It's a very, very big part of how I think about the theater.
So you've been a professor at at least two major universities. Mm-hmm. I know about Yale, right?
And Brandeis.
And UConn, I'm sorry. So is there a disconnect between, you know, a group of people who are used to theater, as you and Kate have just alluded to, mm-hmm. and the people who have not been? And is that our fault? Is that the fault of the professors in the intelligentsia?
Well, that's a very complicated question, and I put a lot of thought into the nature of how we encounter theater through university and not through university. And I think theater in universities all over face the same kinds of questions that much of university life faces, which is university life sooner or later gets to be about university life. And in my way of thinking, of theater never gets to be about anything but theater. And so to keep the two things clear, my way of thinking of it is that even if you study in college and universities, and there are many wonderful programs, including the ones I've been involved with, but what you really need to have in order to get the full experience of what theater actually is to participate in the professional theater. There's just no way around it. You don't get the kind of emphases that you need to understand what it takes to make a career, to get together with a group of professionals and make a good play, and to really think about it in that way is something you can only learn in the professional theater, I think.
So when you sit down with the actors at the beginning of a process for a show, and do you talk about that, of not only what is the show about, what are the things that we want to hit on, but also how do we make sure that the audience gets this? Because there's a million writers that I've talked to have said, well, I'm going to write what I want to write and screw the audience. You know, I can't worry about them, because if I worry about them, I'm going to suffer in the artistic focus of what I'm trying to do.
I think you certainly want to worry about them, but you want to worry about them at the correct time.
And when's that?
When you expect them to be sitting in the seats when you come out for your next entrance.
I like that. So very late in the process.
Very late in the process. That doesn't mean you're not thinking about, as an experienced actor, you certainly think about, well, I wonder what the audience might think here, and, you know, certainly that would influence your choices. But we try not to do that. You would be amazed at what is talked about and what has gone through in a rehearsal process for any play. Doesn't matter what. When actors get together, there are breaks. And those breaks start at 10 minutes and sometimes go to be a half an hour, 40 minutes long. And the reason why is actors have ideas and they want to talk. And they talk. And when we talk about all kinds of things. Sometimes it dips into what the play is about. Sometimes it moves into what the world's doing right now. Sometimes the two tie together. But you have to form a bond with a group of people to put on a play. It's not like just a couple of pros or three or four pros walking through the doors and they sit down and just do their job. It's human beings who have to get to know each other, develop a culture within the company, really seek to understand the play. And when we get to the heart of the play, that's the director's job, to say, the real central topic of this play, the thing we're really mostly going after, is this. So the director's job is to keep the actors focused on to that. And yes, they do talk about that. Anything from, well, it's like listening to the round table, frankly. You go around the table and everybody's got a take on what's going on.
So can I really quickly, we have three experts here. The newspapers, as we all know from the Media Project, are having great fiscal problems. We're lucky here. We have the Berkshire Eagle, which has had an infusion of some real money. Nevertheless, the critics, we seem to see less criticism. The Eagle's done a terrific job of advancing all these plays and everything. But has the lack of criticism affected the way in which people perceive what you do?
Well, I think if anyone's read anything of the Eagles and saw Jeff Borak's name, they'd beg to differ that there was a lack of criticism.
Well, historically, that's true.
Yes. but I think it is very true going around. And I think back in the day in journalism school, it was almost an area that was taught about how you write a critique about a play, how you look and compare other productions, past productions of a show, and going in depth. I think one of the things that's changed is what people are looking for and how they're consuming information about the theater. There are some people who will still subscribe to, a longer trade publication and go for those in-depth behind-the-scenes stories. But I think a lot of people are just on their phones wanting to find out quick reviews, how many stars, who's in it, what's the runtime. I think maybe the demand has waned a little bit. But I think that there is a place for it. And I think there should be. And I think that's part of educating audiences and building audience appreciation for the theater and what's a quality production versus, something
The danger, of course, always.
I'm going to pause everybody there because we have to take a break. When we come back, we're going to go to news break, and we'll come back and we'll pick up this conversation right where we left off. We have a lot more to talk about. We are at the Berkshire Theater Festival, Berkshire Theater Groups. It's the 90th anniversary, and we're celebrating this morning. We couldn't be more thrilled. We'll be back after this short. Good morning and welcome back from our live broadcast to our live broadcast from the famed Fitzpatrick main stage, one of three stages making up the Berkshire Theater Group, 90th anniversary of Berkshire Theater. The wonderful Madeline Gardner, who is your press person, I kept on texting her yesterday, Kate, trying to figure out the right way to say it, because it used to just be the Berkshire Theater Festival, and you could say it was the 90th anniversary of the Berkshire Theater Festival. And then this whole Berkshire Theater Group thing got in, and now it's a little clunky. I don't know exactly how to say it to make it right. So my understanding is 90 years of Berkshire Theater. Is that what we've decided?
That's what we say, but it's really 90 years of Berkshire Theater Festival.
Okay.
It's 90 years the Stockbridge campus.
Yes.
Because the barn, even though the unicorn wasn't in existence the first year as the playhouse was, as we lovingly call the main stage, the Fitzpatrick main stage, but the barn came to us the same year. It was owned by Charles Mellon. He and his wife owned 350 acres on this side of Route 7 and on the other side of Route 7, and apparently he got really tired of his
weeding.
Wife throwing things at him, which she did
in anger or
eggs.
She threw eggs at him.
Eggs repeatedly at him.
How Berkshire.
How Berkshire, right?
Well, also how theater. And like, bring the rotten tomatoes, throw them on them.
To our benefit, in 1928, he said, I've finally had it. We're selling the property, and I'm going to give that pigsty over there to those theater people, and they can use it to build their sets in. And so that's how we got all the property that we have here.
And this is the Mellon people.
Charles Mellon, was part of that family. But Charles Mellon was the head of the New Haven, the New England, the New York Railroad system. He was the head of all of that,
yeah.
And owned one of the mansions. I can't remember the name of the mansion right now, but it was across the street from here.
Well, Joe appropriately brought up the name, the group versus the festival.
Yep.
What would have been so bad about just keeping the festival? We were talking about how we're not fighting enough during the break, so I thought I'd mention that.
I think that when we were thinking about the name and the festival felt like some folks felt like festival just meant a certain period of time.
A defined period of time. I would agree with that.
And we are no longer a defined period of time because we really are year round.
Sure.
And I think there were other names, and I was the one probably that liked group because it felt democratic to me. It felt even based, and we're a group of players. We're a team. Berkshire Theater Team sounded peculiar. Berkshire Theater Group seemed all-encompassing.
Remember when we had democracy? Wasn't that fun? Yeah.
I vaguely remember democracy.
So let me ask a question that I wanted to get back to.
Remember democracy. I'm Greek.
Yep.
I walk democracy. We created democracy and the theater.
Can we get an OPA?
OPA!
Eric Hill was talking before the break about how the conversations among the actors when they're working on a show can vary from about what that show is about to what's happening in the world. So let's say earlier this week, you have the president meeting with Kim Jong-un. Does that come into that? Would that come into that conversation? I mean, maybe it did, maybe it didn't, but it wouldn't be surprising if it did, right?
You would see more.
Just move your mic up just a little bit. That's all right.
You would see more humor in the first 10 minutes of two overweight guys' stomachs meeting 5 minutes before their hands did when they came out to shake hands if you walked into a rehearsal hall with a group of really funny actors. They not only you're following this.
Well,
right?
that's quite a picture you painted there, Eric.
Well,
go ahead.
And then the physical comedy would ensue, and we would get a whole Saturday Night Live riff going
right
off, just spontaneous stuff, or the conversation would go off into whatever realm. But yes, the actors are not only very good at keeping up with contemporary politics, but they are hysterical. They're the funniest people on the planet, actors in rehearsal. And when they get going, I know I've spent half an hour rolling around on the floor on one theme with a group of actors. It's the best way for actors to actually free themselves up. And now I'm going to get serious here for a moment. It's like everything in the theater. A good, hearty laugh opens you up to get you ready for the deeper incisor that's coming. And actors know what's coming when they work on a script, and they know that they need to be open, available, and they need to have the world at their fingertips, no matter whether it's contemporary politics or the latest thing going on. They want to know what's happening so that they have their fingertips on that, so they can absorb it and retranslate it into the work that they're doing. So yeah, they're amazing people. Actors in rehearsal, to me, are some of the most interesting people on the planet.
I would also add that we started rehearsal this week for Hair.
Yeah.
A remarkable group of young folks just arrived, talented folks just beginning their careers, and some of them, you know, have been further along than others. But the cast of Hair is incredible, and all this young energy was in the room. And the first thing that we do is what's called a meet and greet, so we are all meeting and greeting each other. And
there's going to be nudity in that play, right?
Yes, there's going to be nudity.
Okay.
A whole stage full of it.
All right, just checking.
Briefly, but there will be nudity.
All right. Just wanted to throw that out there as the actors are getting to know each other.
This is, you know, it's a different generation. And I really felt like it was my responsibility to remind people why I picked this play. It's the 50th anniversary of Hair. And 50 years ago, there was a lot going on in this country. There were, as we remember, there was violence in this country. We were watching body bags come home from Vietnam. It was a time of great upset, fury. And so while we're all singing Let the Sun Shine In, what was behind Let the Sun Shine In was enormous rage. And I did feel like it was my responsibility to say, I'm not looking for a production that is all about letting the sunshine in, folks. Remember the kids in cages right now.
Do you feel the rage is there? I mean, that seems to be the big problem.
Oh, when I looked around that room at those young faces and saw their body posture as I was speaking, I do have to say that I felt like we were going to be okay, not only with this production, but we're going to be okay.
Meaning in the future, because we have kids like this who are
we have kids that are walking into the profession that are there to speak about what is going on in our world today, and maybe they'll do it through this production of Hair. Look at the kids from Parkland that are out there.
Right.
I mean, I'm hopeful. Maybe only because of those kids.
And a lot of the students from our local area are involved with the local theater programs here.
That's right.
And are bringing that consciousness with them, either as audience members, or a lot of them are involved in the shows at the stage.
13,000 school kids you touch a year.
13,000 out of 16,000.
That's amazing.
It's so important. It was one of the wonderful things about the merger, actually, because at the Colonial Theater, we can have productions where there are literally 100 kids in the show. And we've been doing it time after time. Tarzan will be the show this summer, but about 2 months ago, we did a production of Lion King Jr., where we worked with our elementary and middle school kids only for the first time. And the production was stunning, and the theater was filled for three performances. That program will continue to expand because the kids... Mm-hmm. Yes,
and
Jen,
that was a packed time too, where you had The Lion King. They just came off of a touring show. They have touring shows during the school year, things that I have covered. So this year you worked with a local author to talk about Billy Budd and that production. But then you jumped right into there was a the high school cabaret show, the encore show, and then you had and allowed a local student to produce direct his own show,
Ben
which
Zeller.
I heard was a, like, Travis told me there was a couple hundred people.
No, the theater was like 350 people. Ben Zeller, a young high school kid, it's graduating this year from Lenox High, came and presented me with his original play last year. I said, well, let's do a reading of it. And the next thing I knew, he was doing a full production at the Colonial Stage, and the theater was packed. Mm-hmm. That's the power of social media,
Well,
too.
And I think it's also taking away that we're going back to the idea of how people are intimidated with a theater. I think because the local programs here do such a good job in saying, yes, we're just because of your age, we're not going to discriminate your ideas.
Right.
We're going to allow you to present original ideas. And when I interview students here, they talk a lot about the mentorship that they receive, how they look up to the older actors, and how it didn't make it into my Lion King story, but I asked the students, you know, these are kids who are 15 and younger. Does being part of this production change the way you are as an audience member? And they said, oh, yes. And they started talking about people don't realize what resources they have around here. And to hear that from an 11-year-old or a 9-year-old or a 13-year-old, you know, they got it way better than my generation.
Well, and again, it's something that is happening outside of the confines of school itself. Mm-hmm. In other words, they're going somewhere else. They're going to another institution. They're not. It's not just the theater that happens as part of.
And they're taking their families with them.
And they're taking their families with them.
It brings up this whole conversation. I think last year when I did the summer show, I ended up talking to a group of moms who became friends because they were bringing their kids to the theater, and they became dedicated just like any, you know, sports family would. And I think it makes that pathway better, and it makes them more likely to say, oh, when I pick up this 90th season flyer, maybe we will go see a show aside from the one my child is in.
Right. You know, one of the things that strikes me is that classical music is graying. We know it. And that one of the things that people have been saying about its graying is that orchestras and choruses in many high schools, not here in Berkshire County, but in many high schools around the country, have really collapsed. And when you don't have a kid playing a musical instrument early, as many of us did, it really disincentivizes this from happening.
Well, you want to talk about controversy. You know, ask any music student or professional about budgets.
Sure.
You know, whether it's local, state, or federal budgets for supporting music, theater, and the arts. I get an earful all the time anytime I walk to a school to talk about that issue, or even in higher ed. And, you know, it's... You have to be aware of the economics, the backgrounds. And I think that's why the content that you're seeing on stage is changing. And it's not just about those, you know, staging those musicals that everyone loves. It's about, you know, having a show, having something like Church and State, having, I mean, you guys have this huge agenda of talkbacks with a lot of area thought leaders, from legislator, from multicultural backgrounds, things like that. I think.
Well, just to clarify, Church and State, which you just mentioned casually, is going to be a major thing starting right now. Kate, could you talk about that?
Sure. Church and State started previews last night. It's a play that is witty and funny until it's
not.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It's a play about a senator running for office for re-election. And there's a tragedy in his community, and he rethinks basically everything that he's voted for, and changes his heart and tries to change minds. The playwright is Jason Odell Williams, and each
he'll be
of
with
you,
us later.
Yes, he will. We'll and each of you, thankfully, are coming to join us as moderators, because what Jason asks for is that after each production, we have a talk back. So the play runs, it's 70 minutes long, 75 minutes long, and then afterwards there are talk backs.
But what if we in the talk back crowd don't agree with him? Will he jump out of the audience?
No, the play presents both sides in an interesting way, I think.
There's nothing, but it leaves you with a huge question mark at the end.
It leaves you with a huge question mark at the end, and I think what Jason is really interested in is the conversation. Though, it's pretty clear about the problem with some of our gun laws.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to miss.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up our abbreviated roundtable panel this morning, and we will discuss much more. Let's talk about James Comey for. We'll do that when we come back. I'm still trying to figure out that he had his own private email server. That's like the greatest story I've heard in a long, long
although
time.
Although the private emails didn't feel particularly private to me. I really got to go back through my emails. All right. Now.
Oh. Dig those up. We want those before the end of the show. We have another 2.5 hours.
There's more than 30,000.
We'll be right back after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have everybody with us. We have Kate McGuire, Jen Smith, and Eric Hill, Alan Chartok, and we are talking about what is going on and finishing up our roundtable panel. And then we'll at 10 o'clock, we'll go back and we'll talk about the Berkshire Theater Festival and the 90th anniversary in a little more detail. This report I mentioned right before about the Comey report. Hillary Clinton supporters saw the report on James Comey, the former FBI director, as proof that she was wronged in 2016. It's disappointing and infuriating, said one ally. But then there's also some agony because you have Donald Trump calling the Justice Department report a total disaster for the FBI. So it certainly goes along with the president's narrative that the FBI has been compromised, even though it was very clear within the report that there was no political motivation. The president was on Fox and Friends this morning and said he would not did not want to get involved in the Justice Department matters and would not say whether he believed the former FBI director James Comey should go to jail or not. But I don't know.
Let's just put everybody in jail. Let's put everybody in jail. I think that's what we should do. Just round them all up.
Lock them all up. Dictators.
Well, except for the dictators right now.
Well, let me just say, as I said, 7:45 this morning, but, you know, I don't have any question that Hillary Clinton would be the president of the United States right now if it weren't for Comey standing up there inexplicably saying at the last minute that the FBI was reopening the investigation.
And how many impeachment hearings do you think we would have had by now?
It's astounding.
If Hillary were the president and we got the Republican Congress that we have now, how many impeachment attempts do you think?
You are so right.
Did you see his explanation, though? There's a letter in the Times today from James Comey.
No, a column.
Is it a column?
Yeah.
I mean, I was reading it online, and he was grateful to the IG for the study or whatever you call these things, had a different viewpoint on what he did and just said that he was in a very difficult position.
I think he made a bad decision in a difficult position.
Right.
He
was in an impossible situation. He was. He chose the wrong thing to do, though. He should have just shut up.
If he didn't shut up, then he should have gone into what he was doing with Trump at the same time.
That's right. Exactly. Why didn't that happen?
But the guidelines are shut up. That's the guidelines. You don't talk about an investigation.
I agree with you.
Yeah. He should have shut up about everything and let the cards fall where they may.
The one thing that came out to me that was not discussed during the book tour of Comey's book tour and so forth was this idea of being insubordinate. That there were insubordination, that they had enough people that were saying to the director of the FBI, what you're doing is wrong. Mm-hmm.
But he also was facing people in New York who were clearly talking to Giuliani and other people. Things were leaking all over the place in the FBI. He was afraid that the other offices might get ahead of him and get out to the public with information that he had, and he didn't want it to come out that way. He was facing all of those things at that time.
But Eric, look at Mueller. And the way in which he's operating.
Yeah, total silence.
He just keeps shut. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's very hard to do that. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Comey, clearly he couldn't do it.
No, he couldn't. And I'm not defending him. I'm just saying those were the pressures facing him. He's playing in a league where things, it looks like the umpires walked off the field a long time ago to me, and they're just letting things go haywire.
Still, he should have shut up.
He should have shut up. You're right.
But to Kate's point, You had this going on, which was addressed, and you also had the Russians meddling with our elections, which was not addressed.
Was that because of, was it? I've heard that it was because Obama didn't want it addressed, President Obama.
Well, he was concerned, same thing. He was concerned that how many impeachment hearings would there be if...
Well, we are where we are right now. And so how do we move forward through this? Because those of us that work in the theater, when I'm working with students, I certainly say to them, look, when you're studying theater, study all the methods that are out there, but beware of cults. There are a great many teachers out there that are going to say they're your voice teacher, and they're going to take you down to places that they're not always safe in the end, or they're teaching you about emotions. And believe me, by the time they get done with you, you will be wrung dry. They're cult leaders. And it looks to me, from having worked in the theater my whole life, like we're in the world of a cult leader in Donald Trump, because people are following blindly and they're not thinking. There's not a lot of rational thinking going on.
I have a compliment to that idea, which is, I think what the theater is about ultimately is truth. And in the era of relative truth, or non-truth, or whatever this era is going to be called, who knows? The one thing that we can look to the theater for is a place where we can go and all try our own barometers at good plays, great authors talking about issues that touch on the truths of our lives.
Well, you know, I want to come in somewhere between you and Kate, which is a problem here. Obviously, you're married. You know, because I think everybody claims truth. The president of the United States is claiming truth all the time.
I don't disagree with that at all.
You know,
well, there's a difference between political truth, Alan, and an artistic truth, because I don't think an artistic truth necessarily tries to answer any questions.
You sound just like my friend Jen Smith, and Rex Smith.
And some artistic truths are political truths.
They say, oh, the press is just about truth. Tell me about the New York Post. Tell me about Fox. Yeah. The press is not about truth.
No.
The press is about a particular.
Well, that's what I meant, I think. And the theater is.
Yeah. And the theater is, right. And so you got some right-wing theater guy giving you his view of the truth.
The truth, yeah. But I think that the audience.
What are you staring at, Kate?
Well, I think that
I'm just thinking about all this. I don't even know that the word truth is the right word to be using anymore. I mean,
Oh yes, it is.
I think truth, but I also think right and wrong.
But I don't think
wrong.
You can't
feels
get away from right and wrong.
But you don't get the truth if you're not listening to.
That's correct.
All different sides, and you're not getting That's truth right. if you're not bothering to dig and to ask questions and to reconsider what was previously put before you.
And that's the whole nature of a theater festival, to ask questions from a whole lot of different
sides. I don't think that's true at all.
So you think there's only one dead set?
Well, in some cases it certainly is. You put kids with their, you take kids away, babies away from their mothers. There's truth involved in that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a right and a wrong.
Right, but there's the surface issue, but there's the complexities. I mean, you know, what's the infrastructure of how do you change that? How do you change, you know, years, decades of bad practices, bad policy, and Band-Aid patches to, you know, the immigration issue? Same thing with what was going on with the FBI. It was at the beginning of the absolute demise. The organization was already fractured, you add in an election year and it tore it apart.
We have 1 minute. Who wants the last word?
Maybe it's a time of great awakening, and it is indeed
it
a new age.
You're right. Mm-hmm.
Because maybe we really are saying, let's wake up, let's start thinking deeply, and wherever we come out of this, at least people are awake again.
Well,
because
we've
it
seen
feels
it,
like we've been asleep for a little
bit. But what if we come out as a despotic dictatorship? Which some people think is exactly what Trump would like us to do.
Oh, I don't think that's going to happen in the long run.
But it always
can, Alan. And I think that the warning signs are there. And I think you point them out almost on a daily basis on your radio show. And correctly so. However, I do think that when you get out into the country and you go and talk to a lot of people around the country, you will sense that there is an enormous energy that is working against what's going on, and we'll see whether or not it goes anywhere.
But not the four guys who were sitting next to me at breakfast this morning.
No. I sent those guys over.
Yeah. We'll get to that later. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with the show. Jen, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank
Great
you.
Great to have you
Thanks,
here.
We'll
so good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be back.